Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the resignation of the Pope, an unusual occurrence that has not happened for 600 years. Anthea Butler, a professor of religious studies and graduate chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, joins us to discuss who might succeed Pope Benedict, whose relatively brief tenure was beset by scandals and shrinking church attendance and finances in Europe and North America. Then we'll discuss the issue that Pope Benedict most strenuously opposed, the ordination of women. Erin Seiss Hanna, the executive director of the Women's Ordination Conference, joins us to explain the Pope's hostility to the idea of women being ordained into the Catholic priesthood and his crackdown on American nuns. She has been detained by the Italian police 5 times for peaceful protests against the Vatican. Then finally, with Senator Lindsey Graham promising to block John Brennan's nomination to head up the CIA unless the administration comes clean on Benghazi, we'll examine what really happened in Benghazi with author and journalist Robert Young Pelton. And we will discuss a new e-book by 2 Special Forces veterans, Benghazi, The Definitive Report, which claims to have the answers, along with who was behind the palace coup that ended David Petraeus's career. And joining us now is Anthea Butler, who's a professor of religious studies and graduate chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her most recent book, Women in the Church of God in Christ, Making a Sanctified World, chronicles the history of African-American women's religious lives and civic engagement in the Church of God in Christ, the largest Pentecostal denomination in the United States. Professor Butler's forthcoming book is The Gospel According to Sarah, How Sarah Palin and the Tea Party Are Galvanizing the Religious Right. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anthea Butler.
Ah, thank you. Thank you, Ian.
And the resignation of the Pope, the first resignation of a Pope in 600 years, the last one was in 1415, has taken the Catholic world by surprise. What's your sense of, is there a real reason apart from the stated one, which is ill health or failing health?
There could be another reason, but we won't know it. Ill health is probably the easiest thing for Pope Benedict to say at this point, and that would be very true. There are, however, a lot of things that have led up to this resignation, I think, and I would say the sum total of the toll on his health is probably the reason why he's leaving.
And how much would that have to do with the question of abuse? Because when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, before he became the Pope, he was the recipient of just an endless stream of bad news coming into his office about sexual abuse by priests, particularly in the United States, but all around the world. And he apparently tried to do something about it, but the previous pope, who he succeeded, simply couldn't get his head around it or wasn't interested or whatever the reasons, I'm not entirely sure. But as head of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, he was in the position of basically dealing with sexual abuse. And do you think that, one, the fact that it's gone on and if not gotten worse in his tenure indicates that maybe that is an example of what's weighed him down or worn him down?
Well, I think that's one example. And I think to sort of clarify, Benedict, you know, before as Cardinal Ratzinger, was over the CDF, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. So a lot of the rules that were put into place were rules that were put into place by him, okay? So we can't sort of let him off the hook entirely in a certain kind of way to say this wore him down, because he's actually reaping what has happened since he was over the CDF and then became the Pope. So that's one way to look at this. I do think that it has weighed heavily on his papacy. And this papacy has had a series of terrible things that have happened. You've had the sex abuse scandal. You've had, the Vatican Bank scandal. You've had his personal butler leak information out to the press and to somebody who was writing a book. And so I think there's just been a constant drip and a constant sort of mismanagement, as it were, of the situation. And that's really difficult to do when you're younger, but when you're past 80, that's really difficult.
Well, of course, it strikes me as a huge irony, Anthea Butler, that 2 cardinals who were caught up in the sex abuse scandal and who manifestly failed in protecting children and at the same time coddling priests were the Irish Cardinal Sean Brady and the Los Angeles Cardinal Roger Mahoney, both of whom will be voting on the new pope. How does that strike you?
Yes, they will be. And as that's the case, both of them having had a lot to do with this current sex scandal in the church, I think will have a bearing on how they will look around and decide, you know, and you have to search your conscience and hope that, you know, in church language, the Holy Spirit will lead for a name, that I think they'll be looking for somebody who can help shepherd the church through that process and through the process of healing. Right now, this has really taken a lot of people out of the church in North America and in Europe, and I think that it will be imperative on those cardinals, especially from those two regions of the world, to think about voting for a pope that will be able to help navigate the mess that the church is in right now with the sex abuse scandal.
But the problem has always been that these church leaders, like Mahoney, they're all about healing errant priests and sending them off to retreats. And their priority seems to be to coddle the priests and not bring justice to the victims. And that's why they're in trouble. So, and there's no, I mean, as much as Mahoney has expressed great contrition, are you satisfied that they've learned? I mean, how many years does it take to learn? And how many billions of dollars do they have to fork out before they learn?
Yeah, well, I mean, personally, no, I'm not satisfied. I've been very critical of Pope Benedict XVI. I mean, very critical of a lot of things that I've written. So, no, I haven't been satisfied. And I will say this, though, as a historian, the Catholic Church does not move very rapidly. You're talking about a large structural institution that is all about being right, and they can't see when they're wrong. And when you set up rules that continue in perpetuity to continue to do the same things decade after decade after decade, you know, you find out about something, you try to squelch it, you send the priest away to get some help, they come back, you know, you move them to another parish, so everybody forgets that, and you start this whole cycle over again, which is how it was always done. It's very difficult to change that system. But, you know, I live in Philadelphia, so I can bring up one thing here I think is really important. Philadelphia is the first place in the United States that actual diocesan administrator was put on trial and convicted. And that trial ended, I believe, like last June. And a Monsignor who was doing all of these moving around of priests that had been, you know, abusing, actually is in prison right now. And so I think that what is happening in this particular round is something very different. And what's happening this round is that administrators are being convicted, and that has made a lot more cardinals and bishops nervous because they could be held accountable for the things that they've done.
Again, I'm speaking with Anthea Butler, who's a professor of religious studies and the graduate chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're talking about the Pope resigning for the stated reason of failing health. We don't know exactly the extent of his health issues, do we? It's possible he has a terminal illness, is it not?
Yeah, no, it is possible. But, you know, as I'd like to say, you know, people usually, you die in the chair. I mean, everybody who gets the job knows this, right? And so, you know, I want to bring up something that everybody's been quoting today. Everybody's looked at the 1415 date, I believe, which is when we had three different popes and somebody had to step down. That's not really a resignation. That's being asked to step down because one of those people aren't really the pope. So actually the person we need to be looking at is a pope back in the 1200s who was in for 5 months. And what is interesting about this is that this pope, Celestine V, his grave was visited by Pope Benedict XVI. When he visited that grave 2 years ago, he laid his pallium on the tomb and left it there sort of as it were, like an offering. And so I think that it has been in the back of this man's mind the whole time that he was going to resign, and that he knew he was only going to be pope for only so long.
Well, if that's the case, is he capable, or is it within tradition to groom a successor, or do you have to leave that up to the College of Cardinals?
You got to leave that up to the college, and you can't, you know, you cannot interfere. I think he has set one thing in motion, though, by resigning, and I think what he set in motion is that the fact that when they go into that room, they're not going to elect maybe a 77 or 78-year-old like they did the last time. I think they have to elect somebody younger, and that will be on everyone's mind in that room.
And Andrea Butler, you mentioned earlier the church in the United States, its membership is diminishing, and I think a lot of it's as a result of the child sex abuse scandal in the church, and in general, this sort of jihad against the nuns. Didn't that really backfire? I think that offended a lot of American Catholics, the idea.
Yeah, it really did. And I mean, this yeah, as you cited, this jihad against the nuns has, you know, it hasn't really stopped. Let's just say that. But let's say that the next pope perhaps could pick this up and turn it around in a very different way. They could just let it go. And I think they would be very wise to let it go, because these are the people who've been very faithful in terms of the church and in terms of doing the kinds of services that many of our cardinals and bishops in this nation have sort of forgotten about, because they've been so political lately. So I do think that hopefully, I hope at least, that this will be a turning point.
And what explains the conservatism amongst the male clergy, the bishops and the cardinals, and indeed several, I think, the entire conservative bloc on the Supreme Court are also Catholics, and you're an African-American woman. What explains the extraordinary conservatism of Justice Thomas, and there was another African-American politician who was extremely Catholic in an aggressive right-wing way, Alan Keyes, who actually ran against Barack Obama and lost, allowing Obama to become U.S. Senator.
Well, I think that, you know, when you see a lot of these politicians who are Catholic that really have hardened to the right, this is indicative of a move that's been happening within the church. And so with the Catholic Church getting closer to the religious right, especially in this country, and, you know, aligning with the right in terms of pro-life and other kinds of issues like the health care mandate and all of this, what you see is this whole sense of the conservatism that's in the church is also playing out for conservative politicians who are also Catholic. And so it's easy for them to both get support from, you know, church officials who are on the more conservative side, and it's also a way for them to push up their bona fides with voters.
So given the fact that this pope, who he's only been in for 7 years, I think, and the previous pope, who was in for a long time, have appointed so many conservative bishops and cardinals, isn't it highly unlikely that you'll have anything but a conservative as the next pope?
It's highly likely the next pope will be a conservative. However, I think that conservatism of this next pope, because the deck has been so stacked by Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict XVI, that hopefully it will be someone who has a little more compassion and be a little more savvy. And what I mean by that is someone who will be looking to try to heal the rifts in the church. And I think for a lot of Catholics, the pope resigning is a grave thing, and it brings up a lot of angst for people, because what you're used to is a pope dying and you go through this process. But this resignation, with all the other things that have been happening in the church in the last 4 to 5 years and, you know, beyond, has really put the church on a rocky footing. Now, it's a billion people, and it doesn't have to be on a rocky footing, but I do think that the next pope who comes in will have to be very direct and very much in touch with the people within the church. And I mean that all over the world. It can't be someone who hides behind the Vatican walls and tries to hope that all these things blow away, because they won't.
Again, I'm speaking with Anthea Butler, who's a professor of religious studies and graduate chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and the author of Women in the Church of God in Christ, Making a Sanctified World. And she's also working on a book, The Gospel According to Sarah, How Sarah Palin and the Tea Party Are Galvanizing the Religious Right. Now, it's obvious that, in fact, in many ways, this current pope who just announced his resignation, which is highly unprecedented, not unprecedented, but highly unusual, his main platform was to revive the Catholic Church in Europe and to sort of stem the tide of secularism. And he clearly has failed in that regard. And the more liberal churches in the U.S. and Canada and Europe are declining much faster than the conservative ones are. But in the so-called global south, the reverse is true. Although you do have a more conservative church, people are flocking in particular in Latin America and Africa. So what are the chances of the next pope coming from Latin America or Africa or somewhere in the developing world?
I think there's a good chance. I think if when the conclave meets, I think one of the first things they'll have to think about is that what Benedict put a lot of his stock into was trying to revive Europe, and Europe is, you know, secular. And that just was not happening. And then you could see this attrition that continued to happen once more the sexual scandals came out. You have this huge amount of people who left in Germany, large amounts in Ireland and other places. So that's not where the fulcrum, the balance point of the church is anymore. The balance part of the church is in Latin America, Asia, and Africa. And if they are smart, if they want to have a church that can be more unified, they will pick somebody from that area of the world. One of the names that has come up is Cardinal Peter Turkson of Ghana, who could be one of the top successors, and who is very, very popular there. There are a few other figures. There's a cardinal in the Philippines who looks like he might be sort of interesting. There's even been a name that's been floated from Canada, Cardinal Mark Ouellette. So I think it will be somebody interesting. Now, they could go another way, and I'll just say this because I think it's worth saying. They could decide that because this has been such an upheaval that they might go for somebody who has been close in to the papacy so that they'll be able to have a smooth transition. And that could be another European or at least an Italian. That could be Cardinal Bertone. And that might be an interesting way to think about it. I don't think that's what's going to happen, though. I'd put a pretty good sum of money on this and say that it's not going to be a European.
Well, just in closing, Anthea Butler, it seems to me, though, that almost most of the church's problems would go away if they ordained women and allowed priests to marry. And that's just not going to happen. And if ever there was a pope that was hostile to the ordination of women, it is this current pope who's just stepping down.
Absolutely, very hostile to it. I mean, I think that he has had an enormous amount of a sense in which he did not want to even open the door a crack to women's ordination. However, this is what they are faced with. The next pope will be faced with continued attrition in ranks of priests, also faced with dwindling numbers in North America and Europe, and that's where the money is. So that's going to be part of the problem. And also, there are many women who've been theologically trained who would be perfectly fine as priests. So I think that what the church will have to face is the dwindling numbers of men who want to live a celibate lifestyle, the realization that people from the Anglican Communion and others have been allowed to come in and become Catholic priests with their families, and that's made a lot of people very angry. And the fact that the numbers just aren't there anymore. You've had a lot of seminaries to close, and here in the United States we have a lot of parishes that have priests from other countries that don't know, you know, America very well, and that's been a big problem in the closing of the parishes. And the church is losing money hand over fist. There's many dioceses that are trying to apply for bankruptcy and everything else. So when you put all of that together, you need people who are willing and able and ready to take on the challenges of the priestly ministry. And I think women can do that as well as men can.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Anthea Butler.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Anthea Butler, who's a professor of religious studies and graduate chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her most recent book is Women in the Church of God in Christ, Making a Sanctified World, which chronicles the history of African-American women's religious lives and civic engagement in the Church of God in Christ, the largest Pentecostal denomination in the United States. Professor Butler's forthcoming book is The Gospel According to Sarah, How Sarah Palin and the Tea Party Are Galvanizing the Religious Right. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking further about the ordination of women in the Catholic Church.
God is a concept by which we measure our pain. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I don't believe.
God is with us every day. The illiterate life is with us every night.
Don't know nothing about my soul. Oh, they don't know. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Erin Saiz Hanna, the Executive Director of the Women's Ordination Conference, the world's oldest and largest national advocacy organization working for the equality of women in the Roman Catholic Church. She has been detained by the Italian police 5 times for her peaceful actions at the Vatican, calling for an inclusive and accountable Roman Catholic Church. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erin Saiz Hanna.
Thanks, Ian. It's wonderful to be with you tonight. Thanks so much.
And, Erin, what's your sense of the direction that the Catholic Church will take with Pope Benedict's successor, given that his brief 7-year tenure has been beset by scandals and a lot of missteps on his part, which we could go into, but they're all rather unfortunate. So is there a chance? I mean, one of the things, of course, that a lot of people have been discussing, particularly here in Los Angeles, is that the idea that Roger Mahoney, who's so steeped in scandal, and, of course, the other Irish cardinal as well, are going to be voting for the new pope. So what does that augur to you?
You know, we were as surprised as anyone by the Pope's resignation today, and we've, you know, been scurrying to learn more. We know it's his health that caused this this resignation, and it's really quite surprising, something that has not been done in about 600 years. So as we look at who might be Pope next, you know, a lot of the cardinals in that list are friends of Benedict and are also, you know, very conservative. We do have hope, though, for a new papacy. There's always hope. So in these next coming weeks, you know, we'll be talking with our members and with our coalition partners and trying to discuss with the 11 U.S. cardinals who will sit in the conclave and talk to them about our hopes for what we would like to see happen within the next papacy. The Pope really kind of changed the game a little bit. I mean, even though this has happened 600 years ago, with its new resignation, it kind of changes the Pope from being an office of the Pope to a position, which is, you know, it kind of breathes new life into the Church a little bit. So we'll be, we know that women's voices will not be included in the conclave. They will not be included in the decision-making of the next Pope, and that's very unfortunate. And during that time as well, we will be lifting pink smoke in different cities around the U.S. To raise awareness about the lack of women's voices in the Church.
So since, Erin, you've been arrested 5 times by the Italian police for your peaceful actions at the Vatican, calling for an inclusive and accountable Roman Catholic Church, what keeps you going and keeps you into this church that is so hostile to the notion of women being priests? And it's also particular Pope Benedict has had the kind of jihad against American nuns, which has turned off a lot of American Catholics.
Oh, absolutely. We started the Nun Justice Campaign over the summer to raise awareness about the attack on the nuns and hosted many vigils in support of the sisters. I, of course, went to school and feel I was very much raised by the, you know, Sisters of Mercy. So, I, you know, feel very connected to the sisters and took that attack against them very personally. So, you know, between that and the things that he's done, of course, are very disheartening. But I remain Catholic because I feel like it's in my DNA as a Latina and half Cuban and half Irish descent. You know, it's very much connected to my heritage. I grew up Catholic. It's not something I'm just willing to leave. The Catholic Church makes a lot of decisions that affect women and people across the world when it comes to reproductive health care. You know, they have a seat at the UN. You know, those decisions, it's politics as much as it is a religion. And it's important for women and all people to have a say in that. And that's why I keep fighting.
But the fact that this Pope, who's stepping down, declared that women's ordination is the gravest crime against the Church, and that he he excommunicated all Roman Catholic women priests, and then he personally had Father Roy Bourgeois dismissed from his Maryknoll community for supporting women priests, that's proactive in the opposite direction. I'm just wondering, after 1,000 years. Obviously, nothing's going to. This is 600 years, right? A precedent being repeated. It's about 1,000 years since priests were able to marry, I take it. And I'm just wondering, whether there's a recognition or a growing recognition that so many of the problems that the church has with child sex abuse and et cetera, I think would go away if women were ordained and if priests were able to marry.
Oh, absolutely. I think it would make a huge difference. But I see the things like the dismissal of Father Roy, the naming women's ordination as the gravest crime against the church, all of those things that he has done to fight the leadership of women, I really see those as a desperate attempt to extinguish the good work that we've been doing. No matter what thing he has thrown at us, whether he's excommunicated our people, he has silenced them, he's named it the gravest crime against the church, more and more people continue to join our movement. We are bigger than ever. And I believe we're hitting a tipping point. I just think it's been a desperate grasp of control that he's trying to use, and it's just not working. I think this resignation is really a welcome to a lot of the people of the church that are ready for some change.
Well, you could make a comparison between the first of all, we always talk about the religious right in this country and religious conservatives in this country in the Protestant context, particularly in the evangelical Protestant context. But we never talk about the religious right in terms of the Catholic Church. And it's pretty clear that the male clergy, particularly the hierarchy, are extremely conservative. And in many ways, the nuns are the opposite.
In a lot of cases that's true. I think that's why people really resonate with the sisters, especially here in the U.S. The sisters are with the people. They're running the soup kitchens, or they're in the hospitals. They're running the schools. They're doing the ministry that, we align with Jesus. So I think that's why people are so committed to the sisters, and the bishops and the cardinals are really just, frankly, out of touch with the people who are part of the Catholic Church.
Again, I'm speaking with Erin Saiz Hanna, who is the Executive Director of the Women's Ordination Conference, the world's oldest and largest national advocacy organization working for the equality of women in the Roman Catholic Church. She has been detained by the Italian police 5 times for her peaceful actions at the Vatican, calling for an inclusive and accountable Roman Catholic Church. But what it does seem to have in common, the Catholic Church, as a part of the religious right, I think, is this sort of patriarchal almost Jurassic ritual and control on the part of elderly men, that sort of strikes me as somewhat similar to the Islamic religion and its hierarchy, particularly in both Sunni and Shiism, and then, of course, in Orthodox Judaism, too. So what is it about these big organized religions that are so, the patriarchal attitudes are so deeply entrenched?
I think it's just one word, power. And I always think, it just comes down to power. And in the, terms of the Catholic Church, the power runs deep, and they're simply scared of the ability to lose that to the people of the church, to the laity, and to women particularly.
But the reasons for not ordaining women are that the women cannot, that you have nuns, but they cannot take confessions and deliver the sacraments. And what is the rationale for that?
They've never come up with a good rationale, Ian. Actually, in 1976, the Vatican's own biblical commission determined that there was no biblical, theological reason to prohibit women's ordination. We know that there have been archaeological discoveries that have proved that women served as deacons and priests and bishops in early Christianity. And more than 63% of U.S. Catholics and many Catholics worldwide support women's ordination. So really, they always use the statement, Jesus was a male, so we must have male priests, but Jesus didn't ordain anyone. So, that's why we have so many people that are part of this movement that are ready for change, and they're ready to hear women's voices.
And the fact that the Roman Catholic Church, and under this Pope Benedict, have allowed in conservative Anglicans and allowed them to be in the priesthood. And of course, the Anglican Church has women priests, but it also their priests also marry. So in effect, you've got the nose of the camel, don't you, within the church? You've got married priests.
Mm-hmm.
So what?
We do, yes. What by way of the Anglicans join. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So is that having any kind of ripple effect?
You know, I'm not sure. It's still sort of new. And, of course, the Anglican priests, married priests that they've brought in have been quite conservative, whereas you've had Roman Catholic priests that have left to marry that are not welcomed back in because they are, often cases, very liberal. And we have not yet accepted the male Roman Catholic priest that left to marry to be welcomed back in. So it's a very backward system.
So what's your sense, Erin, of who might succeed? Our previous guest was suggesting that they may actually go for somebody from Africa or Latin America or even Canada. I think she mentioned Cardinal Marc Ouellette, who's a prefect of the Congregation of Bishops. He's been promoted by Pope Benedict because he's famous for having said that abortion is a moral crime, even in the case of rape.
Right. I can't even guess who that they'll put in. I've seen the list, and again, they're quite conservative. It could be from Latin America. The next pope could be. They're saying possibly from Argentina. Another is an Italian. You know, I mean, they have several listed. Even Cardinal Timothy Dolan from the United States is on that short list. Of possible popes, but I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
Well, tell us about the pink smoke and how it sort of reminds me of Code Pink. You know, shook up the Senate. They have on a number of occasions recently in the hearings for the new director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Tell us about how you do these demonstrations in front of the Vatican. Why you've been arrested and presumably going to go over there again. This is all going to happen at the end of the month, isn't it? The smoke's going to be coming up.
Yes, we're making plans to figure out when we can get to Rome. But also, they'll happen. The pink smoke vigils will happen in our communities around the U.S. and probably with some of our coalition partners around the globe. The pink smoke originated in 2005 during the selection after John Paul II. It's something our members came up with. So while the conclave is lifting the white smoke, our people are lifting pink smoke at these vigils to remind the world and to bring around the attention that women are not able to participate in the Vatican selection of a new pope. So we'll be doing that. We'll be doing it here in the U.S., and we'll also be doing it in Rome, hopefully, for the conclave coming up. Our vigils at Rome have been for different times. We were there for the year for the priest a couple years back. We went with Father Roy Bourgeois to kind of defend his case with him. He and I and another woman from womenpriest.org were all detained outside the Vatican. We're always detained for the same things, for simply having a sign that says ordained women. They just don't want us anywhere near St. Peter's.
So the next step, though, in terms of changing the attitudes here, if you can't get a more liberal pope, and there aren't any liberal popes, I think, in the entire College of Cardinals, the United States Church is losing attendance and losing enormous amounts of money, that's got to be getting their attention. What's your sense now when you talk to priests, and presumably you've talked to bishops and others, what is their thinking on why they're so resistant to these changes that could, as I've mentioned earlier, I mean, it's my assumption, and I may well be wrong, that so much of the problems that the Catholic Church are having would literally go away if priests were able to marry and women were able to be ordained. It would, you know, this celibacy thing is not working. It's really unhealthy.
Right. And so, you know, and there are many priests that stand with us in those thoughts. And so, you know, we will be talking to the cardinals and we will be talking with officials in the next few weeks. And what we would love to see the most is simply a pope that's willing to dialogue with us. And while that list is a quite conservative group of cardinals, there's still hope that someone is willing to have a conversation, and it simply won't be silencing of people, the excommunication of people that are simply trying to even ask questions on why women can't be ordained, or calling for the accountability of the sexual abuse cases, or you know, demanding academic freedom, all the things that Pope Benedict really harmed during his papacy. We'll be looking for the next pope. And even though that group is conservative, there's still hope that there can be a change.
Well, just in closing, do you think, I mean, so often throughout history, when churches and their hierarchy become so rigid and so inflexible, that new churches spring up and new branches of the old church spring up. Do you see that happening? Do you see a women's church, Roman Catholic Church, or do you think that? Go ahead.
We do have our Roman Catholic women priests, and there have been over 130 women who have been ordained as Catholic priests, and they serve in their communities, and they have parishes. And while they've all been excommunicated by Pope Benedict, they function as Roman Catholic priests, and they live their lives out of priests, and they do incredibly great work, and are living out their ministry, you know, with their excommunication or not. So we do have that happening in a parallel line. What we would love to see is the Vatican welcome those women and all women who are called to ordination into the fold.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Erin Saiz-Hannah.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Erin Saiz-Hannah, who's Executive Director of the Women's Ordination Conference, the world's oldest and largest national advocacy organization working for the equality of women in the Roman Catholic Church. She has been detained by the Italian police 5 times for her peaceful actions at the Vatican, calling for an inclusive and accountable Roman Catholic Church. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about what really happened in Benghazi.
That you find a pretty face can hide an evil mind. Oh, be careful what you say, or you will give yourself away. Odds are you won't live to see tomorrow. Secret Asian man, secret Asian.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He is the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com and has had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He recently returned from Afghanistan, where he spent more than a month in the field with the U.S. Special Forces. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Hi, Ian. How are you doing?
So tell me, you've really know this fraternity of Special Forces, and there's a Navy SEAL, Brandon Webb, and a former Green Beret and Ranger, Jack Murphy. They claim in a new ebook that's coming out on Tuesday, they claim to have, they call the book Benghazi, The Definitive Report. And it's being promoted as dropping some bombshells about what happened in Benghazi and about the palace coup against Petraeus. From what you've seen of what they're saying, how does it strike you in terms? Because they, as far as I know, they haven't had any direct contact. They haven't actually been in the field in Libya, either of them, have they?
Right. No, I mean, what you're hearing about Benghazi is very multidimensional, because you have the State Department initiative to overthrow Gaddafi. You have JSOC, which is a global anti-terrorism fighting organization. You have contractors who are involved in a $40 million weapons buyback. You have the Libyan or the proto-Libyan government. And then you have the sort of political football that sort of flared up before the election as to the response by President Obama. And then you have the former state Secretary of State Clinton sort of legacy fixing or shaping. So there's a whole bunch of things that collide around Benghazi. But the reality was, this was an extremely serious lack of security and a very predictable event.
And with Lindsey Graham now threatening to hold up the nomination of John Brennan to head up the CIA unless the administration comes clean on Benghazi, they've already had a House and Senate hearings on it. What happened there? Didn't they get what they wanted? Why? I understand that Lindsey Graham is facing a Tea Party challenge in 2014, but what's your understanding of his constant? He said, in fact, after those hearings, that Hillary Clinton got away with murder.
Yeah, what the right wants to hear is that Hillary Clinton was incompetent, that she was a political appointee, that she spent most of her time playing Where's Waldo to rack up brownie points for her 2016 run, while she didn't pay attention to very simple but very serious housekeeping in terms of creating political sort of footprints there, creating proper security profiles. And what you're actually reading in the press is the people on the ground are chatting like schoolgirls. The RSOs, the contractors, the security people are all very vocal about how this event occurred, because they were ignored by the Secretary of State in their effort to create a very low security profile.
Well, my understanding that the low security profile, in particular for the ambassador who was visiting a consulate, which is sort of nothing more than a sort of nice suburban home from what I can tell,
right,
that what this whole thing has been confused with is that there was actually the real operation was a CIA operation, wasn't it?
Yeah. The key to remember here is that the Benghazi was not a consulate. It was an annex. Tripoli was where the consulate was, and there were somewhat level security problems, but the real security problems were in Benghazi. And Stevens didn't spend a lot of time there. He had friends there, and he chose to visit on the 11th of September, which was very odd. And if you look at his schedule is very open and sort of amorphous, which kind of freaked out his security people, because Benghazi was where the CIA operation was, to essentially create militias, buy back weapons, and to sort of mess with the al-Qaeda element there.
And that CIA building is where that's where the SEALs were actually killed, where the mortars were dropped.
Right. They weren't SEALs. They were working for Marcus Vance Marcus, who's a sort of Blackwater-type company who rents out Tier 1 people. And those two gentlemen were directly involved in purchasing or getting back about $40 million worth of surface-to-air missiles.
And what are these guys are claiming, these two special forces guys, in the so-called definitive book on Benghazi, the definitive report?
Well, it's not really a book. It's 83 pages, and it's a Kindle, so it's more of a memo. But what they're claiming is that there was a secret operation run by John Brennan, which is true. You know, JSOC has a responsibility for the entire world.
And that's the Joint Special Operations Command.
Correct. And these people go out anywhere in the world and take out foreign jihadis under the banner of al-Qaeda. And that there was activity in Libya to attrit or decimate sort of growing al-Qaeda elements. And that the attack on the Benghazi compound was essentially payback. And you've seen this in other al-Qaeda attacks around the world, where they go after the intelligence centers, whether it's the consulates or the embassies in Nairobi or Uganda or wherever. So this was definitely payback for the planning and the operations that Stevens was hired to do.
Yeah, but these guys are claiming that John Brennan did not brief Stevens, aren't they?
You know, I doubt very much that Brennan would brief Stevens on a mission level. In other words, they go out and do this on a regular basis. But I'm pretty sure that Stevens would be read in on generally what they're doing there and who the groups were, The funny thing was that Stevens was basically briefing Clinton and the security people at State about how dangerous it was there, because there had been attacks on the British embassy and other areas. There had actually been a car bomb right in front of the Benghazi annex. So he was briefing these people on how dangerous it was, and they were constantly, they, meaning the State Department, was constantly saying, don't bother asking for more security.
And what was their reasoning behind that?
Well, they'd made a decision early on, they being Hillary Clinton, that they wanted to pretend that Libya was doing fine. So they had the Brits go in with their very famous low-profile approach and keep armed guards, keep American presence, American boots on the ground to a minimum. At the same time, they were ramping up this covert or clandestine campaign to eliminate al-Qaeda elements. So it was a left-hand, right-hand problem.
Well, but if and my understanding is that if the actual attack on the annex that killed the ambassador, first of all, I don't think they even knew he was there. There are only 23 bullet holes in the entire building. It was they sort of set it on fire, and he happened to escape to the top floor, and where he died of smoke inhalation. So, was that just a diversionary attack, and the real one was on the CIA station?
No, they knew he was there, and the attack was very unusual in that most of the military activity was blocking movements at intersections, and the actual attack was not a sort of, you know, explosive attack meant to kill people, but actually using diesel fuel to smoke out the people inside the consulate. This was an inside job, and get them to flee. Once they were fleeing, my guess, and this is just my guess, is that they would be then captured and used as hostages to swap for people that had been captured by the JSOC activity. So when they then moved to the CIA compound, it was a completely different attack. It was a very, very violent gun battle between the al-Qaeda militia and the people inside the CIA building. So you had two different attacks, two different places, two different methodologies.
So it was an inside job, and as much as the Ambassador Stevens's guards were tipped off and they just disappeared. And so
correct.
So they set the place on fire in the hope to drive him out in order to capture him, just like they did in this recent attack in Algeria, right? They wanted to grab hostages.
That's exactly right. And the al-Qaeda in that region is just a sort of a burgeoning thing, and it needs funding and it needs the money and hostages to build its way up. I mean, the people in Algeria, the al-Qaeda unit in Algeria, was using almost $70 million worth of ransoms paid by the French government to fund its activity. So it's clear to me that Ambassador Stevens alive would be a much more lucrative and politically useful tool than to just kill him.
Well, but so Robert Young Pelton, again, author, filmmaker, journalist, explorer. He recently returned from Afghanistan, where he spent over a month in the field with the U.S. Special Forces. So I'm just trying to figure out what Senator Lindsey Graham is grandstanding over. I mean, first of all, he said he was also going to block confirmation of Chuck Hagel to become the next Secretary of Defense. They're voting on that on Tuesday at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time. So it sounds like he's lost that one, but he could well hold up Brennan. I mean, he's having this hissy fit over this whole thing. And my understanding is that the subtext here is that, you know, he's you'd think that a confirmed bachelor like Lindsey Graham would be just butt out of this. But wasn't the ambassador just there on a private personal trip? And would that explain why there was so little security? I mean, is there any otherwise it's just really, you know, the Fox drumbeat is right about Hillary. She blew it.
Right, and keep in mind, you know, Stevens was an openly gay man. He had a boyfriend in Benghazi. He'd spent a lot of time there. His schedule was discovered in the garbage floating around the annex. He had a very loose schedule. It was unthinkable that he would actually go to Benghazi on September 11th, but he'd left most of that day open. So, you know, his private affairs that day are well known amongst the security industry, and they haven't really brought that to light, and we don't.
Well, but is that the subtext? Is that what Graham is using, that nobody wants to talk about this because they simply shouldn't talk about it? And in fact, I'm not even sure that we should talk about it.
Well, here's the thing. there are a lot of skeletons that people are pointing to, but nobody's found those skeletons. I don't think Ambassador Stevens' sexual orientation is relevant to what led to the attack. I think the fact that there was so little effort spent to protect him is really the focus here. And secondly, there was a disastrous response to the very violent attack at the CIA annex. There are people in place that normally come to the rescue of these people. There are lots of air assets. We ran a huge multi-billion-dollar air campaign, and suddenly no one's able to come to the defense of these Americans who are trapped by a small al-Qaeda unit. I think that's what they want to grind in to the Democrats to say, hey, you can't fight wars like this. You can't pretend these wars are secret and they can be run on a shoestring.
Yeah, but by and large, isn't there a problem that Obama has a pretty good national security record? He got bin Laden. He's getting out of these ridiculous wars.
He's taking credit for money and things that were approved before he came into office in 2008. The whole drone program, the idea of murdering your opponents using covert assassination techniques, is a Petraeus baby. And it's got nothing to do with Obama. He just knows that it's politically expedient to kill people when people aren't watching. So he still has yet to reap the downside of targeted assassination. I mean, it's just on the upswing after 2008.
But by and large, they haven't really been able to, the Republicans, who normally own national security, they haven't really been able to sully his record. He's been, you know, and he's, let's face it, most of the criticism of Obama comes from the political left. They think he's too right-wing and too pro-military, and he seems to have gone out of his way.
Well, President Obama came in to office just as the funding and the planning for this covert activities came into place. What's happening now is that we are shutting down traditional warfare, in other words, shipping soldiers back who sit in FOBs and get shot at and blown up with IEDs, and shifting over to proxy wars like in Somalia and Mali, and also shifting into the darkness so that you may never know when somebody gets killed by a drone or by a proxy force, which is politically expedient because it doesn't drain the resources or the political capital of the Democratic Party. And as to whether the Republicans can make hay with that, I think the Republicans are somewhat incompetent in understanding how wars are fought.
You mean wars of the future?
Right.
Yeah, so they're... So what then do you make of this claim in this new book by Brandon Webb, the former Navy SEAL, and Jack Murphy, the former Green Beret, Benghazi, the definitive report? I mean, I had Bob Baer, the former CIA officer, on I think a couple of months ago, just after the Petraeus resignation, and he was pretty clear about the fact that he believed that that Petraeus was done in by the CIA, that they didn't like him, that it was a sort of inside job, if you will, because he was dumped on them by Obama, who wanted to get Petraeus off the street because Fox News were recruiting him to become president and run against him. And the CIA were never happy with this guy, and then he acted in a very imperious way, wanting his pineapple 2 pounds a day cored but not sliced, and, you know, having people, you know, CIA officers hand out water bottles on his jogs and, you know,
Well, here's the bottom line is, you know, when you bring a new director and you've got 90 days to break all the furniture and to make all the changes, but if you're saddled with an affair with someone who's quite public and writing a book about what you're doing, you're easy to take down. And the agency does have components where they will take you down by simply leaking information to the media and then suddenly find yourself on the front page of the New York Times. So I'm sure that Petraeus went in and started breaking furniture and they said, oh, well, I guess you forgot about this thing. So the CIA has probably a lawyer-heavy function right now because they deal in so much sort of shifting of the law in terms of targeted assassination. I think they're doing just fine. They have fantastic intelligence. They've had 10 years to gather all this stuff. What they didn't want was yet another person reinventing the CIA.
And it's not about the idea that he was trying to push them into becoming a paramilitary force. They already are a paramilitary force, right?
If you look at the org chart with JSOC, CIA, and all these special operations or special mission groups, the clandestine service, the CIA, is doing just fine killing people. As a matter of fact, that's the big criticism of Obama, is how many people are you killing in these remote areas that we don't know about?
Well, that's why I think the Republicans are desperate, aren't they? And I mean, it seems like Lindsey Graham is having a hissy fit and baying into the wind here.
Yeah, I think what we need to do is focus on how we're going to fight wars around the world. We don't have wars where we sit and line up against the other troops. We have al-Qaeda franchises in over 24 countries now, and we have the ability for people to strike at us inside our own country. So I think that's where the agency works outside the country, the FBI works inside. I think they need to reboot and say, how are we going to protect Americans going forward, not to rehash problems that were created, you know, years ago.
Well, but this whole thing, Benghazi, that was Fox News made it an issue during the election, as you pointed out, but it just won't go away. And I guess it's just an excuse for them.
Here's what happened. I mean, the response to Benghazi was massively incompetent. You had Susan Rice on the chat shows talking about this video. You had all the people on the inside knowing exactly what it was. And you had Hillary Clinton caught with her pants down, or pantsuits down, trying to backpedal on this. And then you had this whole legacy thing where they were going after her in the dying years or dying days of her Secretary of State job, trying to pin Benghazi on her, which I think politicized the whole thing and kept the focus off the murders of four Americans.
And it's still political grist for the mill, even after the hearings. I mean, it's as I say, I think Lindsey Graham's probably just posturing because he's got a Tea Party opponent. I can't imagine. Do you think he's going to be able to stop Brennan?
No, of course not. But I think what he should do is hang the Benghazi albatross around Hillary Clinton and get on with business.
Well, he's tried that. He said she got away with murder. But, I mean, they had their chance, didn't they, when she was testifying. She actually turned it around, and she came across off looking pretty good.
Right. It's a typical Clinton stage-managed event. But the bottom line, it was her security profiles that led to the deaths of four Americans. Had she listened to the people that worked there, the RSOs, the security providers, the military, AFRICOM, there would have been very, very stiff security, and he wouldn't have gone holidaying on September 11th to the annex.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Robert Young-Pelton.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com and has had firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns, and The War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He recently returned from Afghanistan, where he spent over a month in the field with the U.S. Special Forces. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and the Facebook. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.